In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues in the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Okay, good evening. So we're in a commentary by Rongchen Dorje, Third Karmapa, on the Dharma Dharmatava Bhanga, distinguishing between phenomena and their essence. Anybody need the text? We are on page 264. We're focusing on the section on the fundamental transformation, which is their technical term for enlightenment. How enlightenment occurs in the framework of Buddha nature. And we're now on the fourth part, the defining characteristics of non-conceptual wisdom, which is the main cause for the fundamental transformation. And this has three parts, starting with the characteristic of how it abides. The comprehension of the defining characteristics through three points from the Dharma Dharmatava Bhanga. The Karmapa says, you may wonder, how does non-conceptual wisdom abide as the unchanging perfect nature? This is by virtue of abiding in the nature of phenomena, due to abiding in the nature of phenomena that is non-dual and inexpressible. This corresponds to what was taught above as the defining characteristic of the nature of phenomena. With this in mind, the sutras say, no matter whether Buddhas have arrived or not arrived in this world, in the world, this is the very abiding of the true nature of phenomena. So it says above, as was taught above, is the defining characteristic of the nature of phenomena. If you remember, the text went through the nature, went through phenomena, and then the nature of phenomena, and then the fundamental transformation. And the second characteristic, so the first one, how it abides in a non-dual and inexpressible way, which is why that section is so short, presumably, because it's inexpressible. And then we have the characteristic of non-appearance. It is also by virtue of non-appearance, because duality, according designations, sense faculties, objects, cognizance, and the world as the container, do not appear. The word according is a little bit odd. By virtue of non-appearance, because duality, according. What does according mean? Like sort of accommodating? What do you?
Or maybe just related? Like that are in accord with in some way? I'm not sure. I'm just making that up. But
well, let's look at the commentary. What appears as the duality of apprehender and apprehended, what is conceived as names and their reference that are designated by virtue of latent tendencies, the triad of sense faculties, objects, and cognizance that appears as the triad of what is internal, external, and in between, respectively, Interesting that they put the cognizance, the consciousness, in between. Usually the sense faculties are called that which is in between the inner consciousnesses and the outer objects. And the world as the container that appears to the mind as if it were a referent that is other than mind. All these are enumerations of what appear as the aspects of the imaginary and the dependent natures. Since all phenomena that appear in these ways are obscurations of non-conceptual wisdom, anything that appears as these does not exist. Therefore, to match this with the sutras, Maitreya says, thus, through this, the defining characteristic of non-conceptual wisdom is described according to the sutras as ungraspable, indemonstrable, ungrounded, without appearance, without cognizance, and without base. So non-conceptual wisdom is a pretty slippery slope. Therefore, since non-conceptual wisdom cannot be grasped as the duality of apprehender and apprehended, it is ungraspable because the actuality of non-duality is its nature. It is indemonstrable because it cannot be demonstrated through names and words to express it. Since it is not grounded on the sense faculties such as the eyes, it is ungrounded because it is the emptiness of the internal. Since external objects such as forms do not exist outside, it is without appearance, the emptiness of the external. So these terms, emptiness of the internal and external, are from the Prajnaparamita Sutras, where the Buddha goes through a large number of different emptinesses. Sometimes 16, and the largest is 20. And two of the main ones are internal emptiness and external emptiness. Since external forms, such as objects, such as forms, do not exist outside, is without appearance, the emptiness of the external. Cognizance is the dependent. So consciousness is the dependent nature. Usually they say that the Alaya Vijnana, in particular, is the dependent nature. But since all the other consciousnesses come from that, I guess you could extrapolate in that way. And since its reference do not exist, i.e. the objects of consciousness do not exist, non-conceptual wisdom is also without cognizance. There's non-conceptual wisdom. Doesn't cognize anything because there's no subject and object. Is without cognizance because it is without anything to be aware of and anything that is aware. Since it is not an entity that is a base, it is without base because it is the emptiness of the great. If the above six phenomena do not appear as explained here, the true actuality will appear. Therefore, the meaning of being without obscurations is that there is no appearance of names, characteristics, and imagination. If the above six phenomena presumably that's the six ways of describing the defining characteristic, but phenomena is a little bit odd, so it might be the six senses. If the above six phenomena,
therefore, mean they, do they mean the six that are listed, the characteristics?
That's what I was just wondering. There are six of those, and there is also six of the. Senses, obviously, so 688 is perfection. Professor Brunholzl says, it does not shed any light on that. Therefore, the meaning of being without obscurations is that there is no appearance of names, characteristics, and imagination.
So if this is all about the natures, then is this saying that essentially there is no imaginary, and therefore we're in the realm of the, whatever they call it, true perfection or something? Is that what they mean by the true actuality?
If the above six do not appear as explained here, the true actuality will appear. Well, it's suchness, yeah, so that should be the completely perfected nature will then appear. Yeah, that would make sense. That is presumably what the Karmapa is saying. And lastly, the characteristic of appearance, of the three characteristics. It is also by virtue of appearance, because all phenomena appear equal to the center of space. How can they all be equal to the center of space? Won't it get really crowded in the center of space? And because all conditioned phenomena appear like illusions, and so on. By virtue of meditative equipoise, bodhisattvas are free from all clinging to any characteristics of any among all phenomena. It's a little bit of an odd English phrase, isn't it? Bodhisattvas are free from all clinging to any characteristics of, how about?
Try reading it without the parentheses. It's easier, maybe.
Yeah, without. Are free from all clinging to characteristics of all phenomena. Therefore, all phenomena are equal to the center of space because the unchanging perfect nature is seen through the cognition that is attained. Subsequent to that, all conditioned phenomena appear like illusions, mirages, echoes, and dreams, and therefore a mere appearance is because the nature of all kinds of samsara is seen. In detail, according to what is said in the sutra collection, the inner body consists of the illusion-like appearances of the six sense faculties. Objects do not exist and yet appear just like dreams. They are also like reflections and optical illusions. Sounds are like echoes. The appearances of samadhi are like the reflection of the moon and water. All that appears as samsaric existence is like a magical creation. As for seeing all factors to be relinquished in remedies like illusions, the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara says, just like an illusory king being defeated by another illusory king, the dispassionate children of the victors regard all dharmas in this way. That's an interesting stanza because being defeated as a king is a pretty high intensity situation, because usually when a king is defeated, they're either beheaded or tortured or imprisoned. So the Mahayana Samgraha discusses this in detail, the text by Sangha, wonderful text, summary of the Mahayana, or compendium. The aspect of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas is the signlessness in the observed object to be known. So signlessness, just to make sure we're all comfortable with that, is the absence of features that we cognize phenomena by. So when we are notice anything like a book or a laptop or anything like that, anything in our world, we identify it by its features of like color, shape, sound, texture, weight, so on and so forth, position. And in the absence of all those signs is signlessness. And the idea is that This is one of the three doors of liberation. There's the Dharma door of emptiness, which is considered to be the ground, the Dharma door of signlessness, said to be the path, and then the Dharma door of wishlessness, which is said to be the fruition, the three doors of liberation. And signlessness is the path and the sense of seeing. Or this is what Chandrakirti states in his introduction to the Middle Way. And so he focuses on teaching how to understand signlessness by understanding that phenomena are not caused by in any way. And what are the possible ways from oneself, from other, both, or neither? And he goes through all four possibilities in great detail and eliminates them. And the relationship between that and signlessness is that the characteristics of phenomena, because they have not been caused and they're not the result of anything logically, as characteristics, they don't have any sort of conveying power from their own side to convey information about the phenomena as existent, if that makes any sense. But we can look at signlessness from two points of view. One is from the view of the object, and phenomena appear, and we think that they appear with characteristics, but those characteristics are unborn, and they never came about, so they seem to be projected by the apprehender. It's the only conclusion that we can come to. And the phenomena in themselves are without signs, are signless. The signlessness in the observed object to be known, having the nature of connection, what is conceived as meaning is nothing other than that. Through connecting letters with each other, meaning comes from connecting them, which is a wonderful exercise, like of taking a word, the spelling of a word, and removing letters until it no longer conveys the meaning. And then see, like, where does the meaning come from as you put the letters back that indicate the word? Anyway, without an expression, wisdom does not engage in an object of expression. There is no referent. But since the two are contradictory, nothing is expressed, therefore everything is inexpressible. The two that are contradictory would be, I guess, expression and object of expression. It's a little unclear what the two are. Non-conceptual wisdom is the support of the activities of bodhisattvas during subsequent attainment, subsequent to equipoise, that is, since they flourish through it. The aids of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas are said to be the two paths which have the nature of the five paramitas. So that's questionable. Why are there only two paths? And why are there only five paramitas? Any ideas?
Well, I'm going to guess that on the paramitas that maybe they're leaving off the final one because it's the fruition, perhaps. That, you know, if prajna is sort of the end game, that maybe the others are the five.
That, according to the footnote. So the footnote says the two paths here are the path of accumulation and the path of support. Which is presumably Carl's translation for the second path, so the first and the second paths. The former consisting of the practice of the first four paramitas on the path of accumulation being generosity, discipline, patience, and exertion, and the latter being the path of support or the second path of joining or preparation and application, the latter being the paramita of meditation. Through these combined, prajnaparamita, non-conceptual wisdom, eventually arises, implying that prajna as a paramita does not really arise until the third path of seeing, which makes sense. The maturation of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas or the two Buddha mandalas by virtue of application and attainment. And the footnote says, through making efforts in cultivating non-conceptual wisdom, one is born into the mandala of the Nyaya Manikaya, which is his version of the Nyaya. Through attaining the actuality of non-conceptual wisdom, whereas the first one is cultivating it, one is born into the mandala of the Nirmanaka. Through attaining the actuality of non-conceptual wisdom, one is born in the mandala of the Dasambhogakaya. Such maturation does not have the usual meaning of the result of ordinary karmic actions manifesting, but is the very remedy, actually, for karmic maturation. The natural outflow of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas is asserted as its specific manifestations in all subsequent lives. The outcome of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas is to be known as the ten bhumis, since it is attained and then perfected. The outcome, I guess. The culmination of the non-conceptual wisdom of all bodhisattvas happens due to attaining the three pure kayas, which would be the 11th bhumi or full Buddhahood, and due to attaining the supreme masteries. Non-conceptual wisdom is like space, untainted by all kinds of grave evil deeds, and because of mere confidence and devoted interest. That last line got me a little bit. In brief, because the imaginary and the dependent natures do not appear, suchness and the unmistaken perfect nature that engages it appear. This is called non-conceptual wisdom, which does not mean not cognizing anything at all. So the imaginary is unreal, so it doesn't appear. The dependent natures do not appear. They are the this would not be the Chittamatra view. The Chittamatra school view would be that the dependent nature does appear as everything. So this would be more of a Yogacara slant on things from the Vajrayana tradition of the third Karmapa, that the dependent natures do not actually appear. Because they are empty, so they can't. That's a little bit of an odd phrase. You would think it would be like everything that appears is the dependent nature. Okay. Five, explanation of the fourfold comprehension of the benefit of non-conceptual wisdom. The comprehension of the benefit through 4 points, which are, or what are these? Is by virtue of attaining the Dharmakaya in a complete manner, by virtue of attaining the supreme state of bliss, by virtue of attaining mastery over seeing, and by virtue of attaining mastery over instruction. This is the benefit of non-conceptual wisdom. Though the Dharmakaya is its very nature, in a complete manner refers to entailing enlightened activity, which is not something that the Dharmakaya does. Rupakaya, thus enlightened activity. The Abhisamaya Alankara by Maitreya says, the factors concordant with enlightenment, the immeasurables, the liberations, the ninefold progressive meditative absorptions, the ten totalities, the ayatanas of overpowering, divided into eight kinds, dispassion, knowledge through aspiration, super knowledges, the discriminating awarenesses, the four purities in all respects, the ten masteries, the ten powers, the four fearlessnesses, the three ways of nothing to hide, the threefold foundation of mindfulness, the true nature of being without forgetfulness, the latent tendencies being overcome, great compassion for beings, the unique qualities that are said to be unique to a sage, and the knowledge of all aspects. The Dharmakaya is described as all of these. It's quite a list. The 18 qualities that are said to be unique to a sage. So it's vaguely possible that there were 18 listed here. There's four-line stanzas, is 16, and some of them have two. So, presumably that's what it is. The 18 qualities that are said to be unique to a sage are the knowledge of all aspects. And knowledge of all aspects is one of the chapters of the Abhisamaya Alankara, describing the wisdom of a Buddha. Thus, the 144 particular instances of the qualities of the Dharmakaya are explained in 21 sets. There's some big lists for you. By virtue of having completed these, Buddhas are endowed with lasting, uncontaminated bliss. As for the meaning of seeing, Buddhas have mastery over seeing because they see all noble objects in their richness and variety. So the last footnote on the quote there, the Dharmakaya is described as these, Carl says, note that these verses describe the qualities of the Dharmakaya. Its 27-fold enlightened activity is described separately. So these are some of the aspects of the Dharmakaya. The 144, by virtue of having completed these, Buddhas are endowed with lasting uncontaminated bliss. As for the meaning of seeing, Buddhas have mastery over seeing because they see all noble objects in their suchness and variety, the two ways of knowing ultimate wisdom. Of the mastery over instruction, this is what Alankara says. Instruction, the Mahayana Sutra Alankara says, but the speech of the Sugatas is infinite and has 60 inconceivable branches. The speech, with frequent repetitions through well-formulated phrases which expound, discriminate, and remove doubts, is for those who understand through concise statements and elaboration. Interestingly, aspect of repetitions listed first, and in the context of other qualities that are clearly positive qualities. And so the repetition seems to be a positive quality. Being pure of the three spheres, the teaching of the Buddhas is beneficial. It should also be understood as being free from the eight flaws. laziness, lack of understanding, inopportunity, uncertainty, not removing doubts, inconclusiveness, weariness, and stinginess, which are presumably the eight flaws. These are asserted as the flaws of speech, since the teaching of the Buddhas lacks these. It is unsurpassable. Thus, this refers to mastery over the speech that teaches through 60 branches. The 60 branches of speech of a Tathagata, of a Buddha. That's an unusual list. Well-formulated phrases, all detailed and brief forms of teaching, the arising of all qualities and being free from these eight faults of speech. Having explained the fourfold benefit of non-conceptual wisdom in this way, there follows. What was the fourfold benefit of non-conceptual wisdom?
Was that in the first thing by attaining the Dharmakaya in a complete manner, for attaining the supreme state of bliss, attaining mastery over seeing, and attaining mastery over instruction at the top of 268?
It would have to be that, yeah. It's by virtue of attaining the Dharmakaya in a complete manner, one. By virtue of attaining the supreme state of bliss, two. By virtue of attaining mastery over seeing, three. And by virtue of attaining mastery over instruction. These are the four benefits. Okay. Having explained the fourfold benefit of non-conceptual wisdom in this way, there follows the comprehension of the thorough knowledge. This has five parts, beginning with the brief introduction. The comprehension of the thorough knowledge in four points consists of the thorough knowledge of being a remedy, the thorough knowledge of the defining characteristic, the thorough knowledge of the distinctive features, and the thorough knowledge of the functions. Thorough knowledge of being a remedy, thorough knowledge of the defining characteristic, thorough knowledge of the distinctive features, and thorough knowledge of all the functions, You may wonder, how is non-conceptual wisdom to be known? It is to be known through these four points. The second aspect of this is the explanation of non-conceptual wisdom being the remedy of the five factors. First, you may wonder, for what is this non-conceptual wisdom a remedy? Here, the thorough knowledge of being a remedy is due to non-conceptual wisdom being the remedy for the fivefold clinging to non-existence, that is, phenomena, persons, change, difference, and denial. So that's the fivefold clinging to non-existent phenomena. That is phenomena, persons, change, difference, and denial. Therefore, the factors that are to be overcome by non-conceptual wisdom are the following five in this part, despite their non-existence. The factors that are overcome by non-conceptual wisdom are the following five, despite their non-existence. So you overcome things that are non-existent. One, clinging to phenomena as having an entity. Two, clinging to persons as having an identity. Three, clinging to phenomena as arising and ceasing, their changes despite their non-existence. I think that should say, i.e., to phenomena as arising and ceasing their changes. Four, clinging to difference, clinging to phenomena, nature of phenomena as being different, despite their not existing as being different, their not existing rather as being different. And five, denial, denying even the existence of merely imputed existent phenomena and persons. So the merely imputed existent phenomena and persons presumably would be the non-associated formations.
Oh, you think that's okay? I was thinking that this sounded almost like the last one was like nihilism.
Denial. Let's see, clinging to difference and denial. They don't say clinging to denial.
But all five are cling. It's fivefold clinging to yeah. non-existence, and so denial is one of the five non of the.
Clinging to denial.
That are clung to.
Denying even the existence of merely imputed existent phenomena and persons. The factors to be overcome by non-conceptual wisdom are clinging to phenomena as having identity, clinging to persons having identity. Clinging to phenomena as arising and ceasing, clinging to difference and denial is overcome by non-conceptual wisdom, denying existence. So superimposition and denial. One should understand that non-conceptual wisdom is the remedy for these five. This teaches the meaning of comprehending the relinquishment of the two extremes, such as the two identitylessnesses, lacking arising, lacking ceasing, and being free from being one and different. That is discussed in the Madhyanta Vibhaga. The relinquishment of the two extremes, such as the two identitylessnesses. Okay. The Madhyanta Vibhaga has a list of 10 subjects that one has to come to know. And it sounds like these are part of that. Explanation of the defining characteristic.
Sorry, and whose is the Madhya?
That's Maitreya's,
that's Maitreya's
text.
Yeah. That's another one of them.
Uh-huh. Another one of the distinguishing between middle and extreme.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
The thorough knowledge of the defining characteristic is by virtue of its specific characteristic of excluding the five factors of lacking mental engagement, transcendence, complete subsiding, what is naturally non-conceptual. And picturing. It's a little bit of a convoluted text, isn't it? Through the teachings on non-conceptual wisdom, one should understand a specific characteristic of excluding these above five errors. That's reasonable. Some assert that non-conceptual wisdom is the mere lack of mental engagement. This is not the case. A lack of conceptions about aspects exists even in small children, but one is not liberated through that. The vanishing of examination and analysis is called transcendence. This is not non-conceptual wisdom either, because the second dhyana and so on are states without examination and analysis. So the vanishing of examination and analysis is what happens as you move from the first absorption state to the second. And there's two types of conceptuality or mental activity that occur on the first that are eliminated in order to move to the second absorption. And those are examination and analysis, vitarka and vichara. This is not non-conceptual wisdom either, because the second dhyana and so on are states without examination and analysis. which is sort of redundant because that's how you get there, is by eliminating them. But also lack the qualities of non-conceptual wisdom. Nor is it reasonable for this wisdom to have the nature of conceptions having subsided completely. The states of being asleep, being intoxicated, and having fainted would also be this wisdom, because these states are without conception. So non-conceptual wisdom is not the vanishing of examination analysis. It's not being without concepts. Nor is it reasonable, for what does naturally not entertain conceptions, to be this non-conceptual wisdom, such as the sense perceptions, presumably. Are non-conceptual, but they're not non-conceptual wisdom. If such were the case, objects such as form would also be this wisdom, because it is by their very nature that they do not have conceptions. They're without conceptions. Five, non-conceptual also indicates that it is not reasonable for picturing to be this wisdom. Picturing. For if one mentally engages by thinking non-conceptualities like that, such a thought about non-conceptuality is nothing but a conception. A concept about non-conceptuality. Thus, non-conceptual wisdom is what is free from these five factors. In brief, fools who have not learned designations, the mere vanishing of examination and analysis, the temporary states of conceptions being at peace in the dhyanas, and unconsciousness being something like matter, and the apprehension of mental characteristics are taught to be the five factors that do not accord with non-conceptual wisdom. So five factors that do not accord with non-conceptual wisdom are, in brief, fools, one who has not learned designations, one who has not learned how to discriminate phenomena, presumably, is the first two, is the vanishing of examination analysis that happens in the second jhana and above. Three is the temporary states of conceptions being at peace in the jhanas and consciousnesses, which is similar. Being something like matter, matter has no concepts, and the apprehension of mental characteristics. The apprehension of mental, so that's what self-awareness?
I think that's probably the picturing one for whatever reason.
Yeah. Picturing.
That was the fifth one.
For picturing to be this wisdom. The apprehension of mental characteristics. Interesting. Do not accord with non-conceptual wisdom. Therefore, the Mahayana Sangraha describes its nature as follows. It neither bears on that nor on something else. It is neither knowledge nor non-knowledge. Not being different from what is known, the knowledge is non-conceptuality. Since there is nothing to be conceived, all phenomena are explained to be naturally non-conceptual. Therefore, this wisdom is non-conceptuality. The matter of this teaching on the nature of the non-conceptual prajna of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the Mahayana Sangraha is discussed in this text here in the matter of eliminating its antagonistic factors. Okay, so it lifts that from the Mahayana Sangraha. And then fourth, the explanation of the five kinds of distinctive features. The thorough knowledge of the distinctive features is by virtue of the five distinctive features of being non-conceptual, unlimited, non-abiding, lasting, and unsurpassable. This wisdom is more eminent than those of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas by virtue of five distinctive features. How is it eminent? The wisdoms of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas entail conceptions because they understand samsara as a flaw and nirvana as a quality. These wisdoms are limited because they focus merely on the great characteristics of the four realities of the noble ones. The general characteristics of the four truths. They also abide. Sorry, they also abide somewhere because they abide in nirvana. Their wisdoms are not lasting either because they become extinct in the nirvana without any remainder of the skandhas. For this is explained in the sutra passages on the path being like a raft. They are also unsurpassable because Buddha wisdom surpasses.
They're surpassable, not unsurpassable.
Thank you. They're also surpassable because Buddha wisdom surpasses them.
In the sentence where it says,
so that's the distinctive features of Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas. Sorry.
I was just trying to figure the wisdoms are not lasting. Either because they become extinct in the nirvana without any remainder of the skandhas. Is this saying the wisdoms become extinct?
The wisdoms of the Shravakas.
This is describing the state of the Shravakas and Pratyekas.
Yeah, their wisdom is extinguished when they enter into the non-abiding nirvana.
Right. So essentially it's that cessation state or whatever we call it does not have wisdom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's right.
Interesting.
Because they don't, there has no characteristics. There's no activity at all. And the nirvana without remainder, not the non-abiding nirvana. The non-abiding nirvana is the Mahayana nirvana. Hinayana nirvana is either with remainder or without.
So in this case, this is saying that at the time that they essentially pass away. Out of their bodies, they've got no wisdom there. And so it's interesting. But the they that becomes extinct is the wisdom, not the being, right? They're talking about the wisdom becoming extinct.
It seems that way.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
They also abide somewhere because they abide in nirvana. Their wisdoms are not lasting either because they become... No, I think it's they become extinct.
No, well, it's no, actually, I think... No, because as you say, they abide... The wisdoms are limited. They abide... Is the they referring to the beings or the wisdoms in that prior one?
These wisdoms are limited because they focus merely on the general characteristics of the four realities. They also abide somewhere because they abide in nirvana. Their wisdoms are not lasting either because they become extinct. I think it's the Shravakas Pratyekabuddhas become extinct. But it's pretty much the same meaning if you take it as the wisdoms become extinct.
Yeah, maybe it's not that different. Curious. Okay.
They are also surpassable because Buddha wisdom surpasses them.
That one is easier to understand. Yeah.
The wisdoms of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, on the other hand, are characterized by the five distinctive features that are the opposite of the above. They are non-conceptual because they do not conceive of flaws or qualities of samsaric existence and peace. Whereas the Shravakas understand samsara as a flaw and nirvana as a quality. Bodhisattva's wisdom is characterized also by, number two, they are unlimited because what they take as their objects are the specific and general characteristics of all knowable objects precisely as they are. Whereas the Shravakas Pratyekabuddhas focus merely on the general characteristics of the four truths, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas focus on all phenomena. Three, they are non-abiding, because without abiding the samsaric existence through prajna, without abiding in nirvanic peace through compassion, they train in there being nothing to be adopted or to be rejected. And they are lasting by virtue of the Dharmakaya as their foundation of being permanent. Their continuum, and again, the they is either the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or it's their wisdom. By virtue of the Dharmakaya as their foundation being permanent, their continuum does not become extinct, even in the nirvana without remainder of the skandhas. So even if they attain that arhat-type nirvana, they don't become extinct. And five, they are unsurpassable because there is nothing more eminent above them. In brief, the wisdoms in Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are taught to be non-conceptual because of the purity of samsaric existence and peace. Knowing all that is to be known by wisdom and being the unity of emptiness and compassion, that is, having attained the unconditioned Dharmakaya and the consummate state. Okay, part five on the explanation of the 10 topics of the transformation. The five functions of wisdom. The thorough knowledge of the functions is by virtue of the fivefold distinctive features of function: distancing from conceptions or distancing conceptions, accomplishing unsurpassable bliss, freeing from the afflictive and cognitive obscurations, the two obscurations to enlightenment, engaging in all aspects of knowable objects through the wisdom that is attained subsequent to it. Subsequent to the freeing from the afflictive and cognitive obscurations. And five, purifying Buddha realms, maturing sentient beings, and granting the knowledge of all aspects. The wisdom performs the following five functions. As for distancing conceptions, the root of mistakenness consists of conceptions and the beginningless arising of the latent tendencies of ignorance about suchness. The nature in which such does not exist arises as a matter of course in seeing that all aspects are without arising. As for unsurpassable bliss, by virtue of not lacking the knowledge of all knowable objects, this wisdom is accomplishing skill and means. By knowing all knowable objects is a way of accomplishing skillful means. Such occurs due to having accomplished the nature of uncontaminated bliss by virtue of being free from the three kinds of suffering: the suffering of pain, the suffering of change, and the all-pervading suffering. As for the afflictive obscurations, through realizing that the intense arising of desire, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, the five kinds of views, as for the afflictive obscurations, which is the first of the two obscurations, through realizing that the intense arising of the kleshas and the five kinds of views. And the five kinds of views, so these are the six root negative mental factors. The five listed and the the five kinds of views as the sixth: desire, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, and the five kinds of views. The five kinds of views are the view that takes the transitory collection to be the self, the view that one's own view is supreme, the view that there's a panacea, that there's like one thing that you could do that would like solve everything, the view that there's no karma, and the view that the Four Noble Truths are not accurate, or the five views, and the 20 secondary. So then there's the 20 secondary afflictions. So as for the afflictive obscurations, through realizing that the root afflictions and the secondary afflictions comes from the conceptions that depend on subject and object, all of them. Non-conceptual wisdom liberates from them because it goes beyond subject and object. through looking inward at the alaya consciousness, the afflicted mind, which is generally the seventh consciousness, particularly in the third karmapa's context, the afflicted mind functions as the support for the arising of the afflictions. And this mentation that dwells in the alaya exists in all three realms as a latency that is to be relinquished through familiarization, which would be a way of indicating the fourth path, the path of what we normally call or see called meditation, but really means familiarization in the sense of familiarizing oneself with the true nature of reality as being beyond conception. But what was seen in the path of seeing. So the seventh consciousness that dwells in the alaya exists in all the three realms as a latency that is to be relinquished. So what happens in the path of seeing is that we uproot through looking inward at the alaya, the afflicted mind functions as the support for the arising of the afflictions. And this meditation that dwells in the alaya. So that's the normal situation. The seventh consciousness is the support for the arising of the afflictions by looking inward at the alaya consciousness, the eighth. And this meditation that dwells in the alaya exists in all three realms as a latent tendency that is to be relinquished through familiarization. So the path of seeing uproots the clinging to the apprehension of there being something real, and then the path of familiarization uproots the latent tendencies that the presence of that clinging created over innumerable lifetimes. Through not conceiving both imputed and innate afflictive obscurations. So, sometimes called acquired and innate, through not conceiving both an imputed and innate afflictive obscurations. So in some systems, there's imputed and innate afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. Are also of those two types. In some systems, they don't both have both. Through not conceiving both of them and realizing that they are illusion-like, non-conceptual wisdom is freeing from the obscurations. Okay. Through this, the contaminations, including their latent tendencies, are overcome. Once being, so that would be the contaminations would be like the path of seeing, and their latent tendencies is the path of familiarization are overcome. Once being liberated from ignorance through this without characteristics and conceptions, all focal objects appear in an illusion-like manner, and there arises the wisdom of subsequent attainment. That is engaging in all aspects of these illusion-like knowable objects. So specifically, the wisdom of subsequent attainment is what occurs on the path of familiarization. It's subsequent to the path of seeing, the wisdom that arises in the moment of the path of seeing. As taught above, through the great fundamental change of mentation. So the mentation in this scheme is generally a term for the sixth consciousness. So going back up to the sentence about the alaya, through looking inward at the alaya consciousness, the afflicted mind functions as the support for the arising of the afflictions. That's the seventh consciousness. And this mentation, the sixth consciousness that dwells in the alaya, exists in all three realms as a latency that is to be relinquished to familiarization. So the seventh consciousness is uprooted at the path of seeing, and then the mental consciousness is purified of the latent tendencies through the path of familiarization. And then the alaya consciousness is uprooted at the path of no more learning. And number five, back down, as taught above, through the great fundamental change of mentation, six consciousness, perception, the five consciousnesses in conception, the five sense consciousness in conception, which is part of mentation. Non-conceptual wisdom is purifying Buddha realms, maturing sentient beings, and granting, that is causing the attainment of the knowledge of all aspects. These three also function, are also a function of non-conceptual wisdom. So I think this is the idea of the transformation of the consciousnesses into the five wisdoms. The great again, five is taught above through the great fundamental change of mentation, perception, and conception. Those are the three groups of three groups of the eight consciousnesses, the sixth, one through five, and conception is part of the sixth. Anyway, these three are also a function of non-conceptual wisdom, purifying Buddha realms, maturing sentient beings, and granting the knowledge of all aspects. It is a function of non-conceptual wisdom. This principle is found in the Uttara Tantra in the following manner. Their minds set on accomplishing beneficial activities, perpetually blazing like fire, while always being immersed in the absorption of the dhyana in peace of peace. If you followed that, wow, he's saying that all of these, either the last three things, purified Buddha realms, etc., or all five are summarized in the Uttara Tantra. Interesting. Okay, accomplishing beneficial activity, Buddha realms, that's maturing sentient beings, perpetually blazing like fire. Anyway, as for the last three above, which would presumably be numbers 3, 4, and 5, being taken as a single function by Maitreya, they represent a single function because three distinct functions are perfected through the single factor of non-conceptuality. Among these five functions, the first and third depend on conceptions. Really, the first is distancing conceptions. The root of mistakenness consists of conceptions and the beginningless arising of the latent tendency of ignorance about suchness. Back down at the bottom of the page, among those five functions, the first and third depend on conceptions, and the two obscurations as the factors to be relinquished. That's clear. The others are based on what is to be attained. If the above five points are understood in this way, this is called the comprehension of thorough knowledge, which is also another like chapter in the Abhisamaya Alamkar. This comprehension of the thorough knowledge should be understood according to the Avikalpa Kalpa Pravesha Dharani, which we read at the beginning. One should understand that after the setting of this sutra, what is taught consists of the manner of the correct training, entering the dhatu non-conceptuality, its characteristics, signs of having entered it, its activity, an example, and through the other remaining passages, the means to enter that dhatu. However, I do not write down the words of the sutra here out of fear of being too wordy. I will repeat that sutra. But if you remember, it had this whole analogy about mining the earth and the gems and gold and all that stuff. Anyway, that's sort of fascinating to see how into the Maitreya text the third Karmapa was. And like really dissecting them and like seeing all the stuff in these Maitreya texts. One wonders if anyone else ever saw. I wonder if he wrote commentaries on the other five, other four. Okay, seventh topic is the explanation of the mental engagement, and this is two parts to what bodhisattvas engage mentally and the manner in which they engage mentally and the progression of that. Through what bodhisattvas engage mentally, as through the comprehension of mental engagement, bodhisattvas who wish to engage in non-conceptual wisdom by all means engage mentally by thinking the following. Because they definitely need to engage in non-conceptual wisdom, the foundation of the fundamental change. Those who have the mindset for engaging in the supreme jnana have the courageous mindset for great enlightenment, and have the welfare of sentient beings in mind, should engage mentally in the following manner. Okay, so the seventh point of mental engagement has various parts, the second part of which is the manner in which they engage mentally and the progression, which itself has three parts, of course, starting with the examination of the manner of being mistaken by virtue of the alaya conditions and ignorance appearing but not really existing. Okay. False imagination. And going back up to the root verse in the middle of the page, right? As for the comprehension of mental engagement, bodhisattvas who wish to engage in conceptual wisdom by all means, engage mentally by thinking the following. False imagination, which contains all seeds, the cause for what does not exist, appearing as duality. So the seeds are the cause for the apparent duality of what does not exist. And the other continuum that is based on that, false imagination, what contains all seeds, and the other continuum that is based on the seeds. What is the other continuum that is based on the seeds? Occurs due to being ignorant about suchness. What contains all the seeds is the Alaya Vishnava. The other continuum based on that probably is the seventh consciousness, occurs due to being ignorant about suchness. Therefore, what entails cause and result appears, but it does not exist. As taught above, one part of false imagination is the Alaya consciousness that contains all seeds. Based on the imagination that while not existing in actual reality forms karmas through the seven collections of consciousness, the Alaya consciousness arises subsequently through being produced and accumulated by that false imagination. So the Alaya consciousness has these different aspects. It's the container, the receptacle for all the seeds, and then it gives rise to the container, the environment, and it gives rise to the experience within that container. So, based on the imagination that while not existing actual reality forms karmas, the imagination that forms karmas through the seven collections arises subsequently through being produced and accumulated by that false imagination. For the cause for the duality of apprehended and apprehended appearing from it, the Alaya consciousness, while not existing, is its being seized by the latent tendencies of clinging to duality. So the Alaya consciousness is seized by the latent tendencies of clinging to duality, which are also part of the Alaya consciousness. The other continuum that is based on that consists of the six operating consciousnesses that appear as if arising from objective conditions. So those are the two continuums. The seventh consciousness abides in the Alaya and provides the power for the arising and ceasing of the other six consciousnesses, which is explained as the mentation, that is the mind, immediately after these six have ceased. And thus the phrase, the immediate mind or consciousness that the Karmapa uses in other contexts, right?
And so that's putting the mentation into the seventh.
Seventh.
Which is also, this is a thing that I think Trungpa Rinpoche also does, where it's both the afflictive and it's got that function of the immediate.
Yeah.
Which always confused me a little bit, but I mean, that's its sort of dual Well, okay, so that explains
Yeah.
also that earlier thing of
So
meditation being the seventh.
it has those two qualities. So it abides in the Ollie and it provides the power for the arising and ceasing, and which is explained as the meditation that is the mind immediately after these six have ceased. So it provides the power for the six consciousnesses, and then it is there immediately after the six consciousnesses subside. Bye, Neil. Take care. Happy Thanksgiving. It is also referred to as the Dhatu or Ayatana of meditation. Okay. Through the condition of meditation being afflicted by virtue of being associated with four afflictions that look inward. The four afflictions that look inward. According to the Mahayana Sambandha, these four are the views about a personal reality, self-conceit, attachment to the self, and ignorance. Okay. Suchness is not recognized. Due to that, mind is mistaken, and this mistakenness arises from the latent tendencies of ignorance that exists since beginningless time. Therefore, this represents being ignorant about suchness, which is the cause of mistakenness. Consequently, what entails mutual causes and results appears, but it does not really exist. For example, through mistaking a rope for a snake, one is afraid, and being afraid produces further mistakenness. You run around trying to kill the rope. Thus, in all respects, suffering resembles a snake not existing in a rope and yet appearing glorious. Rahula Bhadra. Rahula Bhadra. Who is Rahula Bhadra? Just as when mistaking a rope for a black poisonous snake, one becomes afraid merely through seeing it. Oh, friends, people with clinging are fettered by the flaws of two objects. 7:23. The two texts by Rahula Bhadra and Atenger do not contain this verse. I love that sort of footnote. These Tibetans always quote these other texts and then they don't appear in the text. It's very weird. So either they make up the quote to fit the circumstance, or they have other versions of the text that actually do have those quotes, and those versions get lost. It's a mystery. Somebody should someday write a paper on like the fictitious quotes. Because this happens all the time. You see that footnote. The text doesn't actually have that quote in it. Anyway, the second part of the second part, or something like that, of the seventh part, the matter of mental engagement, by virtue of its appearing, the nature of phenomena does not appear. By virtue of its appearing, the nature of phenomena does not appear. By virtue of its not appearing, the nature of phenomena does appear. I think by virtue of its appearing is phenomena. By virtue of phenomena not appearing, nature of phenomena. Anyway, bodhisattvas who mentally engage in this way engage in non-conceptual wisdom. Oh, that's a mind bender for you. This is the matter of mental engagement on the path of preparation. The second path through the imaginary, which consists of apprehender and apprehended, appearing while not existing. What does not appear is the focusing on the nature of phenomena, which is established primordially. On the unmistaken path of engaging in that nature and on the fruition of that path. So, okay. Through the imaginary, which consists of apprehender, which consists of duality, appearing while not existing, duality appears without existing. What does not appear is the suchness, is the focusing on the nature of that phenomena, which is primordial, and so forth. Therefore, one is mistaken by virtue of that nature appearing and apprehender and apprehended not appearing, true reality in the path with its fruition do appear, which would be the path of seeing. Bodhisattvas who mentally engage in this way engage in non-conceptual wisdom.
You could call this a koan in this context, right?
All of it.
But this one in particular,
This
they
one in
really do.
particular, by virtue of its appearing in nature, phenomena does not appear. That's a good call, those two lines. Okay, this is also stated in the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara by Maitreya and the Mahayana Sangraha by Asanga. So presumably, Asanga quotes from Maitreya's text, the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, in the following way. There is the investigation of names and reference being mutually adventitious, and the investigation of the two kinds of imputation as being mere such imputations. Through understanding how things really are with reference not existing, there is only threefold conception. Threefold conception. The agent, the recipient, and the activity, something like that. And since that does not exist either, one engages in the threefold seeing, the threefold purity, that it does not exist. Three conceptions. Oh, refers to the remaining three conceptions about names, natures, and distinctive features. Okay. Thus, this says that when the cognizances that appear as names, causal features, and imagination do not exist, the triad of the nature, its stainlessness, and the path towards that stainlessness is observed. And thirdly, the explanation of the progression of that realization, which has, of course, many parts to it. The first of which is observing as cognizance. By virtue of such observing, they engage in observing everything as mere mind cognizance. At the time of the lesser illumination of the prajna about the non-existence of something apprehended that is different from mind on the path of preparation, through realizing the principle explained above, bodhisattvas observe both mistaken and unmistaken cognizances as not really existing as anything other than mere cognizance. Through this, the level of heat arises, which I think is the first of the four experiences on the path of preparation. Bodhisattvas who have excellently gathered the accumulations attained, the causes for calm abiding and superior insight, Shamatha Vipassana, through the nine methods for settling the mind, and the 11 mental engagements. Also, the 11 mental engagements is a scheme by Vasubandhu for Vipassana that the Karmapa then goes through in the ocean of certainty in his presentation of Vipassana. Kempo Soltram went through those. Let's see, 727. These are investigation, examination, fine analysis, calm by experience, arterial union, lucidity, non-conceptual, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, through being endowed with the dhyanas, they focus on the three doors of superior insight, which I think are what I just went through earlier. These are the three doors of superior insight. I see. When in the text by Jamgon Kaltral on the treasury, in the treasury of knowledge on Shamatha Vipassana, he gives three ways of characterizing Vipassana. He gives the Vipassana of the four types, which are analyzing, discriminating, fine analysis, and fine discrimination. And then he gives the three characteristics, which is this. And then he gives the six discoveries, words, meanings, so on and so forth, right? Time, direction, so on. So the three, where are we?
Doors of superior insight.
Right, right, thank you.
728.
This is found in the Samdhi-Nirmocana Sutra. It consists of the kinds of superior insight that arise from characteristics, investigation, and discrimination. The first one means to identify what identitylessness means and thus mentally engage in its characteristics, but not by using a lot of reasoning. So an initial glimpse of identitylessness. Investigation refers to relying on reasoning to gain certainty using syllogistic reasoning, presumably, and then discrimination means to further analyze points about which one has already gained certainty. That is extraordinarily helpful. Thank you very much. Because that scheme, that threefold scheme, is not that well explained elsewhere. And it turns out to be the main scheme for Vipassana. In that text, John Luke Cultural then returns to it and says that the six discoveries are included in the three, and points to that scheme of three as being the main scheme for Vipassana. So that's, I believe I circulated the footnotes, right? Yeah. So 728, okay, cool. Let's see. And the six discriminations of entities, so that's the six, yeah, that's also in the Jhana cultural text. This means to analyze all afflicted and purified phenomena in terms of the meanings of words, entities, characteristics, classes, time, and reasoning. Now here Carl does not cite any source, and I've had these emails with him about, like, what's the source for that scheme of six? And it's not clear what the source of that is. The other two are in the Samdhinirmocana. I think he said he feels it's in the Samdhinirmocana, but it's not stated clearly. Anyway, and thus engage in mere cognizance. The Mahayana Sutra Lamkar says that having become such bodhisattvas, meditative equipoise, except for mental discourse, do not see any reference. Except for mental discourse. That's odd. Thus they engage in mere cognizance. Secondly, not observing any reference. By virtue of observing everything as mere cognizance, they engage in not observing any reference. At the time of this illumination of prajna, having become middling, when everything appears as mere cognizance, any external reference are not observed. This is the level of peak. So that's the second of the four levels in the path of preparation, because the illumination of phenomena is stable. It's either the second or the third. Mahayana Sutra Lamkara continues, in order to increase the illumination of phenomena, they make stable efforts. Through the increase of the illumination of phenomena, they abide in mere mind. Third, the explanation of engaging in not observing cognizance. By virtue of not observing any reference, they engage in not observing mere cognizance either. If any reference do not exist, mere cognizance is not established either, because cognizance depends on reference. And this is the level of approximately concordant posed readiness. That's a very odd translation for the third stage of the four levels of the path of preparation. Wow. Through this, they see all appearances of reference as being mind. At this point, they relinquish the distraction of the apprehended. So they relinquished, so this is this progression of these four stages, right? Well, let's complete it. Since cognizance does not appear as the duality of apprehended and apprehender, vice versa. The next point is observing no difference. By virtue of not observing that cognizance, they observe the lack of difference between those two. Those who do not observe cognizance do not observe the two of apprehender and apprehended. Both of them are alike in appearing as mere cognizance, and they are also alike in that there is no really existing apprehender if there is no really existing apprehended. Therefore, they lack any difference. This is the contact with the level of the Supreme Dharma. So that's the fourth level of the four levels of the path of preparation, the level of Supreme Dharma. The Mahayana Sutra Alankara says, then solely the distraction of the apprehender remains. At that point, they swiftly touch upon the uninterrupted samadhi. Thus, immediately upon that, the distraction of the apprehender is it relinquished. The distraction of this massive cognitive obscuration. Thus, to familiarize with this progression of realization constitutes the more eminent path in preparation of the Mahayana. In due order, these phases should be known as being heat and so on. 734. Anyway, those are the four levels. Lastly, and then we'll stop, explanation of nature. The non-observation of these two in this way is non-conceptual wisdom. These two being the apprehender and apprehended. It lacks an object and lacks observation because it is characterized by not observing any characteristics. The lack of appearance of these two, apprehender and apprehended, all phenomena appearing like the center of space and all noble objects appearing like illusions and so on, constitute the path of seeing. Through cultivating it, all stains are eliminated, and this is perfected through lacking any observation of the six objects on the inside or outside, being the six objects of the senses, presumably, and not observing any characteristics of factors to be relinquished and remedies as well as the characteristics of suchness. And the fruition, this is just as taught above. So even relinquishing suchness. So just briefly to review that. So the first stage was on the top of page 277, I think. Using the verses from the Mahayana Sutra Alankara, then having become such, bodhisattvas dwell in meditative equipoise except for mental discourse. They do not see any reference. And then secondly, in order to increase the illumination phenomena, they make simple efforts to increase the illumination phenomena. They abide in mere minds, the second. And third is, through this, they see all appearances reference. At this point, they relinquish the distraction they apprehended. And then fourth, they then solely the distraction of the apprehender remains. At that point, they swiftly touch upon the interrupted samadhi, and immediately upon that, the distraction of the apprehender is relinquished. So the four are no reference, mere mind, the apprehended, and the apprehender. That's very cool. I've only been trying to figure out what happens on those four stages of the path of preparation for like 50 years, but it's great. So let's end there. Draw a big arrow on the top of 279. And I was sort of hoping that we could have time next time to read through the, I don't know if we got further than we were supposed to tonight or not.
It looks approximately like where you were aiming for. Not well, the first item on the next one is page 280, so it's close.
Ah, we almost made it. Okay. I was sort of hoping in the last class we'd have time to read through the root text again and see if we could, like, understand a little bit more than the first time when we read through.
That would be nice.
Yeah. That would be a nice gift after all this effort. So, I did manage to record, thank God. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much for persevering in this. And nice to see you. Take care. Have a great, wonderful Thanksgiving, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Huge feasts or small ones. Have fun. Enjoy. See you
Happy
next week.
Thanksgiving.
Take care. Stop recording.